about 10 minutes, and we'll use the guillotine.
I believe in an incentive system, so that should work. Thank you. I'm a native of Philadelphia, so it's a great pleasure to be here in Boston. That's not really the way I meant it. It does seem a bit late in the day to be asking the question of whether the Cold War is over. In the last 2 months, if you read the op-ed pages, we've seen acknowledgments of its demise from Gene Kirkpatrick, Charles Krauthammer, Bertrand Neal Pines, General William Odom, William F. Buckley last night. Just to give you one quotation, Kirkpatrick, writing on March 1st in the Washington Post under the title "The Stalinists Are Not Back," said, she was surveying recent developments in the Soviet Union, particularly the reverses on the domestic reform front. "They reflect no return to a Cold War. They do not guarantee peaceful resolution of the problems inside the Soviet Union, nor do they guarantee the evolution of the Soviet government toward democracy. In fact, there are grounds for concern on all these issues, but there are no grounds for concluding that the Stalinists are back in charge." Krauthammer speaks similarly, Pines, William Odom, etc. So I'm not sure if there's going to be, well, I shouldn't say there won't be a debate. I think there will be a debate, but I'll leave that to you. It seems to me the demise of the Cold War is so widely accepted that on February 26th, the Washington Post reported the formal disbanding of the Warsaw Pact, but placed it on page 16. I've always dreamed of reading the headline on page 1, so my dream was dashed. I don't know if it was played in other cities, but it seems to me that says something right there, that's played on page 16. Where will they put the demise of NATO? I don't know, back in the comment section. Now, I don't mean by citing these names that I want to make an argument from authority or that we should decide whether the Cold War is over by some head count, but I think it does indicate something when the people I've named conclude that the Cold War is not on. You might want to debate whether it's going back, but slightly different. It seems to me it ended with the revolutionary changes in Eastern Europe, which was, I think you could look at it this way, that was a however it might have come about, regardless of the intentions of Gorbachev, it was an act of unilateral disarmament by the Soviet Union. I don't believe the Cold War would resume without undoing those changes, and I don't believe that's in the cards. The people of those heroic countries are not about to let that happen, and I also think that it would not happen without some major American provocation, which I don't see either. Now, it happens that I'm just back from the Soviet Union, where I attended a Cato conference in Moscow that featured the full spectrum of political thinkers, from orthodox communists such as Yegor Ligachev and Vadim Bakhatin, if you want to call them thinkers, to such pro-marketeers as Stanislav Shatalin and Ed Crane. And no Soviet that I ran into had foreign policy on his mind. Everyone over there is preoccupied with the economic mess, and I doubt whether even the most unreconstructed communist thinks that the way out of that mess lies in confrontation with the United States. In fact, I strongly suspect they would think that would only hasten the disintegration that's going on, rather than slow it down. Now, since I see no prospect for a new Cold War or for continuation of the old one, I wanted to briefly revisit the old one. Because for all that's been written about it, there is an aspect of it that has been sadly neglected. This is all the more tragic because I think an appreciation of it would save us some trouble in the future under circumstances I can't quite imagine right now. When we think of the critics of the Cold War, we tend to think of Soviet sympathizers or some variety of left-winger or enemy of American way of life. But there was a group of early Cold War critics who fall into none of these categories. They were proud Americans and passionate advocates of basic American institutions, constitutionally government, private property, and the free enterprise system. This group has come to be known over the years as the old right, to distinguish it from the newer right. Actually, I should call this the old new right that formed around William and Buckley in the National Review in 1955. Since then, there's been a new right, so it gets a little confusing. Scorecards can be purchased out in the lobby. The leader of the old right was, of course, Senator Robert Taft, Mr. Republican. And it featured a distinguished group of publicists and politicians, including Felix Morley, a founder of Human Events, Frank Chodorov, a founder of ISI, Congressman George Bender, Congressman Howard Buffett, and many others, including John P. Flynn, the journalist who, in 1955, 1956, could not get a book review published in the National Review because he was more concerned about the domestic effects of American militarism than he was about the Russians. Their concern about the Cold War was that the jihad mentality of Harry Truman and John Foster Dulles and other architects of the Cold War, including many, many military Keynesians, we shouldn't forget, caused them to forget that the first requirement of troop security was a sound economy. Taft and his colleagues believed that military strength without economic strength was a chimera. They pointed out that to the extent we undermine economic freedom, we undermine economic vitality and thus the security of the American people. So they repeatedly issued jeremiads against high taxes, big budgets, deficit spending, the weak dollar, and inflationary monetary policy. Unfortunately, they were ignored, largely, I think, for public choice reasons. And the military-industrial complex grew, that they had warned about, grew to where more than one-third of the engineers in the United States were working on militarily-related projects, and research came to be more and more dominated by the federal government. I believe we're still suffering under the consequences of this distortion of capitalism. The old rightists were just as concerned that the Cold War would dangerously bloat the executive branch and risk autocracy, and I think we recently had a demonstration of that danger. If we ever find ourselves back in a Cold War, I hope these views will be heeded. Now, I know some people will be wondering, how can I say what I'm saying? After all, we won the Cold War, didn't we? We exhausted the Soviets in the arms race and knocked them out of the box. This has a superficial plausibility, but it overlooks an important point. Socialism, and we heard a little of this earlier, socialism is inherently bankrupt because, as Ludwig von Mises pointed out more than 70 years ago, it defies rational economics. Without property, there is no exchange. Without exchange, there are no prices, and without prices, there is no means to make economic calculations, i.e. socialism destroys a key tool of reason, calculation. Thus, socialism cannot run a large-scale industrial economy. This is true whether or not the Soviets feel compelled to produce armaments. In fact, as the old right suggested, the pressure to produce armaments could well have prolonged the Soviet system because it provided a rationalization for the deprivation that was imposed on the Soviet people, namely the threat from the West. The old right's preferred policy was to maintain America's founding ideals and a strong, free economy by avoiding government interference. That would make the United States the envy of the world and draw to it a tight circle of allies who would want to be associated with the consequent economic benefits. When NATO was being debated in Congress in 1949, Taft said, quote, "Can we afford this new project of foreign assistance? I think I am as much against communist aggression as anyone, both at home and abroad, certainly more than the State Department. But we can't let the communists scare us into bankruptcy and surrender, and the surrender of all liberty, or let them determine our foreign policies. The one essential defense against communism is to keep this country financially and economically sound." On another occasion, he said, "The limits to the cost of this militarism cannot be foreseen." Now, the old right tended to oppose the twin policies followed alternately over the years, trade restriction on one hand and trade subsidy on the other. This audience needs no lessons in the fallacy of subsidies for foreign aid to communist regimes, and this is one very important thing to be reminding the government and the American people that there should be no government to aid, no government to aid regarding the Soviet Union or any other government for that matter. However, the old right went further and expressed doubt that restricting Western economic and cultural contact with the Soviets would hasten the demise of communism. Orville Watts, an old right educator, debunked the embargo strategy, writing that government restrictions on private trade with communist countries strengthen the Iron Curtain because embargoing trade also embargoes subversive ideas, subversive from the point of view of commissars. In 1959-55, he wrote the following. "An American, for example, cannot walk down a Moscow street without conveying to passers-by certain truths about the outside world. Through the quality of his shoes, the cut of his clothes, his unafraid bearing and peaceable manner, everywhere he goes and in every contact he does or says things which teach the meaning of freedom and expose the lies on which the Soviet rulers depend or inculcating fear and hatred of capitalism and of the peoples practicing it. By all means, let us work for a revolution behind the Iron Curtain, but for this, we need carriers of revolutionary ideas. In selecting the best means of accomplishing this revolution in Russia, let us not arbitrarily and emotionally reject the effective means of peaceful traders and travelers. Now, the upshot of all this, in light of today's events, is staggering. U.S. policy over the last 40 years or so may have actually prolonged communist rule and delayed the crack-up we are witnessing today. Furthermore, the lesson to be drawn is that, Cold War or no Cold War, we should let nothing take precedence over expanding the free economy in the United States. Thank you.